Okay, is this on? Ladies and gentlemen, can I have your attention, please? Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, colleagues here from the LSE, welcome to this referendum night here at the LSE. My name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm the head of the European Institute here at the school, and the European Institute is proud to be hosting tonight's event. It is, I think, the European Institute at its best, that is, bringing together different parts of the school, colleagues from across a number of departments, the economics department, the government department, international relations, law, many sections of the school coming together to analyse and explain this very important political moment in our history. And we're very grateful to all of the speakers from within the school and beyond for their contributions this evening. You'll have seen the programme. It is a very impressive list of speakers. Naturally, of course, a referendum night like this requires the tremendous efforts of a number of colleagues, a whole host of people across the school. I'd like to recognise in particular the admin support team in the European Institute and my colleagues Emma, Marion and Carl Ludwig, the LSE press office, the LSE blog teams, our technical support staff, the stewards, the security and the catering. My thanks to all of them for the tremendous effort they've made to make this evening possible. As you'll see from the programme, we're actually hosting tonight's event in collaboration with the research programme of the Economic and Social Research Council, the ESRC, the programme on the UK in a changing Europe. And we're very pleased to welcome the programme director all the way from across the streets of King's College London, Professor Anand Menon. I'm sure, as a colleague from King's College, he was able to manage this intellectual journey from King's to the school, and we're very grateful for that personal achievement. Some weeks ago, we published the LSE Commission report on the future of Britain in Europe. This was steered by academic colleagues across the school, and in particular, colleagues in the European Institute. I believe some of you here tonight have helped us compile that report, contributing your knowledge and expertise. And copies of the report are available for you in the foyer. Let me emphasize, they are available to you free in the foyer. And you can read those documents, those summaries, and I think the journalists amongst you in particular would find this a very useful background of the issues of the campaign. I've already said that many, many people have made tonight's event a reality. But two of my academic colleagues in the European Institute deserve special mention. Tonight would simply not have been possible without the tireless efforts and the leadership of my colleagues Ian Begg and Sarah Heyman. Could you please join me before going any further in thanking these two colleagues? We can truly say, of course, that tonight is a momentous point in our history, whatever the results. Many of us will no doubt remember this day and indeed remember the political campaign for some time to come. And perhaps you will also remember where you first heard the news and the analysis of the implications. So we thank you for spending this time with us. Some of you are colleagues from across the school, staff and students. Others are journalists, diplomats, academics, experts, practitioners of one type or another. You're all very welcome, and I hope you'll participate very actively in the various discussions which will be taking place in this theatre and also in some of the smaller theatres in this building. To lead us through to the wee small hours, we're very pleased to have our colleague from the school's Institute for Public Affairs, Conor Gearty. He will be, in effect, your compere for this evening, and he has the simple task, the very simple task, of making sure that everything that happens on the stage this evening runs very smoothly. And I can think of few better people to celebrate or commiserate with than our much respected and rather loquacious lawyer all the way from Ireland, Conor Gearty. So let me hand over to him, but let me also thank you very much for coming.
Yeah, that's the kind of attack on a nationality that's been... You have no idea how much pressure we Irish are under. Thank you very much, Kevin. That's terrific. It's a very lively, fast agenda, and my job is to keep it moving, so let me get straight to it. This is the commission, and LSE does better than anywhere else that I know, anywhere, at combining deep scholarly thought and policy interventions, and this kind of event. There are three. I don't know if anyone does it remotely as well. We're here till 3 a.m. We're here till 3 a.m. The cast will be in this, so I'm not going to waste time taking you through it. If you all got a copy of this little booklet, very good, very good. Mostly, if you haven't, try and get one as we work our way through the evening. There's been changes, and that's because of pressure of events. People pulled out, not because they couldn't be bothered to turn up, but because they're needed by the President of the European Parliament or by their own governments. That is in the nature of this beast. If you're sitting here thinking, my God, I'm going to be listening to all these academics, I'm going to miss the story is going to be here. It's not going to be that for the next, I'm trying to work it out, 6 hours. We're going to be hooking up onto the TV, and we're going to be breaking now and again to know what's going on, and we're going to have some notes from Sky at 10 o'clock. So we're going to wind up a little early in the first panel, and we're going to go to Sky on one of these screens, and Sky say they're going to be able to tell us stuff. We'll probably see a little weird head of Rupert Murdoch in the background. But I don't follow what nationality he is at the moment. I think he's every nationality that works commercially. I'm not allowed to do that, am I? I must control myself. And during the evening, if we get some breaking stories and news, we'll put it up. So we're going to stop and we're going to go where something like Gibraltar, and hands up who knew they voted, Gibraltar, we'll probably ignore them. But the Isles of Scilly, I think that's a wonderful place to start with this referendum, don't you? The vote from Scilly. And then there's some other places coming in. And when something extraordinary happens, there's a man over there on my right, Tony Travers, who is a multiple personality involved in so much at LSE. His job will be to walk on, did you know this, Tony, and say, something extraordinary has happened. And then you're supposed to tell us what it is. But there you are. Now, it's not just happening here. More on the rules here later. It's not just happening here. It's happening around this building. There are dedicated side sessions where we develop other and more specific points. There's a particularly exciting one to look into and dip out of in one of the rooms around here. I can't remember which one it is, Thai or which one? Alumni. That's a hint to give money to LSE. There's an alumni theatre.
Say that again, Tom.
And we have Nicola Wright from the library who's here. And the library has created a fantastic exhibition which is reflective of the campaign from 1975. And we have here, at that, and he's already spoken, we have here a man for whom 1975 was only one-third of the way through his electoral engagements. We have Sir David Butler, who's already spoken. David Butler's first election experience was with his mother in 1931, and he's covered every election. Is this right, David, since 1945? And I have a nephew in the middle of Ireland, And he spent yesterday, not knowing you were coming tonight, looking at your broadcasts from 1950 to 1975. He could not believe you were here. So it's an amazing thing to have to have David. Can we give him a round of applause? Give him a round of applause. Now, before you get the idea that this is all a put-on for Remain, LSE has many, many, many different people, and LSE happens to have created UKIP. We have in LSE, and he's performing tonight, a brilliant speaker, Alan Skedge. Is Alan in the room? Alan's speaking the case for Brexit, I think it's called, and he's on at 11 o'clock, and you shouldn't miss that. It's in one of the rooms. It's in your programme. And we have UK in Europe at the World at midnight, and that's our IR friends also in the programme. And we have, amazingly, Gideon Freese, who is the former counter-terrorism supremo in Europe. And one of the key issues, as you know, has been the security issue. Interestingly, the Home Secretary coming out in favour of Remain on that ground. We have the guy who knows more about it than anybody else speaking directly about it in that session with colleagues who are in the panel lists already. We have a press briefing at 11:15 p.m. for the press, but you can wander in and pretend you're press if you want to sample the excitement of being in the media. And we also have a press desk. We have a press desk, which is where? Upstairs somewhere. Just over there. And it's manned, I think, optimistically, by press advisors from LSE. There's a pay bar. I've been given four free drinks, which I think is highly risky. I assume you haven't. There's food. They have. You all got free drinks. This is ridiculous, Craig. You've lost control of the finances. And there are people in red shirts wandering around who are called stewards. They won't bring drinks to you. It's not a waiter service here. We're not one of those fancy new cinemas. But you can have that outside. If you want to hashtag it, we are hashtag LSE Brexit. And there's one important thing before... It's there. One important thing to say, because we've done these in the past. This is not a beach. When you leave, do not leave your metaphorical towel. Do not leave your bag. We want to keep this room energized. And so be absolute. We've got the judgment on numbers right. There's space in the room. If you want to go somewhere else, don't say, I'll keep those seven places in case those friends who said they might come will come, and I want to make sure I can come back in if I want to come back in. We do not want Tony Travers. He talks a lot today. He doesn't want to be speaking to bags at 2:15, and nor do I. So the stewards will certainly keep an eye on that, because people want to come and people want to go. So I do ask you to do that. And I am not, it's not impossible, I will challenge you as you leave, having left a bag. I am an aggressive moderator. Now, timings. We have two minutes for our wonderful director of LSE, who supports such events like this, and Anand, who's already been mentioned. Craig, you've got a minute. Anand, you've got a minute. Away you go.
All right, I'm going to talk really fast. I want to welcome you all. I want to say this is exactly the sort of thing that the LSE does brilliantly, and that is an important reason to have an LSE, because there is no university in the world, and certainly not in Europe and the United Kingdom, that can engage as effectively in key public questions, bringing knowledge to those questions, and allowing everyone to have a beer while this goes on. I want to join in thanking Ian and Sarah, and indeed Kevin and Connor, and at least Kevin. I want to stress that this is an event that took collaboration across the LSE. Those of you who work in universities, including the LSE, will know that collaboration across all the departments and institutes and other nooks and crannies of universities is not easily accomplished. And this is an event that the European Institute, the Institute of Public Affairs, made possible by working with colleagues throughout the university. The European Institute is a hub. It is not an encompassing bureaucratic organization with extensive dysfunctions and regulation on the size of umbrellas. It is a hub for intellectual activity in the LSE. And this is also made possible by collaboration with a wider range of institutions. Kevin mentioned, and I would second, the ESRC, and Anand Menon will speak next. But I cannot let you go without some substantive remarks. First, I am absolutely confident in the outcome of this referendum. That sets me apart from Simon Hicks, who has been reading poll data on the basis of which he has doubts. But mine is a faith-based analysis of the events, which I regard as appropriate to this post-evidentiary era of political campaigns. Second, it is true that I have a plane ticket to California. But that is little solace because California is planning a campaign to leave Donald Trump's United States. It's called Kexit. Seriously, I actually really mean seriously, the question of Europe is not only a question for and about Europe, it is a global question. These events are momentous for the UK, they are momentous for Europe, and they are momentous for a world which benefits from European leadership, has benefited from European leadership, would like to benefit, and needs to benefit from European leadership in the future, and will suffer if it doesn't have it. Fourth, regardless of the outcome of this referendum, there will always be an England. There might always be a Britain. There will probably always be a Europe. And there will definitely always be an LSE. Thank you.
And now an ad.
Thanks, Connor. As Kevin intimated, it's always profoundly humbling to be at the LSE. And while I grapple with my sense of intellectual insecurity, I do promise not to gate crash on this LSE loving for too long at all. I just want to make a couple of thanks and one comment. The first thanks, actually, and I figure that if David Cameron could play fast and loose with Purdy yesterday, I can do it today, is to the SRC, because they invested in our programme and actually uncharacteristically showed a degree of courage in doing so, because this was always going to be a politically horrible referendum. It was always going to be a referendum in which people were going to be attacked for disagreeing with other people. And I think the fact that the SRC came up with the courage to invest in this and to back us all the way actually deserves our thanks first and foremost. Secondly, I just want to thank our team in the UK and a Changing Europe who have worked tirelessly for weeks now, round the clock in some cases, and your efforts do not go unnoticed. And thirdly, I want to thank the academic fellows on the programme, many if not most of whom are here. Ian and Sarah we've heard about, Simon's over there, Matt Goodwin, Angus. There's some of you I haven't mentioned because I didn't write a thorough list down, but I just want to say your efforts have been fantastic. You've worked above and beyond the call of duty, and actually I think you and this programme have helped to change the way that the media and the public see academics, and I think that is fundamental. And I think one of the things I set out to do with this programme was to show that academics can be influential, not just in shaping public policy, but in shaping public understanding of public policy. And I'd like to think that we have made a first small step along that road. So I'll leave you and the fellows in particular with a warning. I do not see tonight as an end, but a basis on which we're going to build with more hard work in the future to continue our task. I'll just say to you now, have a fantastic evening, drink all the LSE's booze, do not leave a drop, and have a great time.
Right, thank you. We don't have a huge amount of time for applause. Can I ask the first panel to come up? Matthew, Sarah, and Simon. We're going to finish this one at about 21:58. And we're going to ask them, as they come up, to speak reasonably briskly, and I'll start to enforce it. 5 to 7 minutes, guys. The order I've got is Matthew, kick off, Sarah, second, Simon, third. I am not going to spend time on bios. They are distinguished, and they are here, and there are lengthy descriptions of them with sometimes pictures of them some years ago at the back.
What are you suggesting?
Matthew, do you want to kick off? You've got about 5 or 6 minutes on the electorate. How do people choose their vote?
Okay. Welcome, everybody. I'm Matt Goodwin, and for the next, what feels like the next week, we'll be analysing the referendum results. So here's what I think is interesting about the referendum. This is not really about the blue-on-blue warfare. It's not really about the stuff that we're reading about in the newspapers. I actually think what's playing out in this referendum is a very real, very present, very sharp divide within Britain and within British society. Ultimately, a divide that is really separating social groups who have fundamentally different sets of values. And I think that's the important part. I don't really think of this so much in economic terms, but rather in terms of values. We are almost certainly going to see a strong Leave vote tonight. That's my personal belief. I think at least 45%, possibly higher. And that will carry all kinds of implications. It might not be a majority vote, but it will be a very loud and very clear message from a particular sections of Britain who feel that the EU is not working out for them, who feel that globalization is not benefiting them, and who feel that Westminster elites are not listening to them. And if we, you know, look back over British politics pretty much since 2010, that group has consistently made itself heard, and that group will make itself heard in the early hours of tomorrow morning. You know, the Leave vote is going to be very tribal, it's going to be very loyal. We have no reason empirically to expect that Leave vote to simply disappear. We know that it will turn out, we know that from last May. The big question mark for me is whether the middle class progressives and young Britons will turn out. And we've had a series of opinion polls over the last 2 weeks, over the last 2 days, that I think would worry me if I were in the Remain camp, that have delivered a pretty strong message that Remain is fairly comfortable. You would have seen the populist poll today that put Remain 10 points ahead. If I was a Remain voter this afternoon, looking at the thunderstorms and the torrential rain, while also flicking on Twitter and reading about these polls that put my side 10 points ahead, I might think, well, it looks like we're safe. Maybe I should stay at home. And I think that's what's going to be interesting, seeing that one play out. But overall, you know, we know that one group of voters tonight are going to be looking at this from the point of view of wanting to protect Britain's economic position. And we know that another group of voters are going to be looking at this from the point of view of wanting to reduce immigration. It's very difficult to see how this referendum will actually unify those two groups. If anything, we may leave this referendum campaign even more divided than we went into it, because as a country, we are divided on this question by three, along three dimensions. We're divided by social class, we're divided by generation, and we're divided by geography. Middle classes want in, working classes want out. The young want in, the old want out. The urban, diverse, younger, more affluent cities want in. The rural, economically disadvantaged, East Coast, left behind communities want out. None of that will be resolved tonight. So I think we should keep that in mind as we watch the results unfold on the screen behind us. Because I think British politics is going to be interesting for the next few years. But I don't think we're going to resolve anything this evening. So maybe we should go home.
Thanks, Matthew. Brilliant. I'm very good on the old time. I think we said Sarah, didn't we?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree with everything Matt has said, but I also, I guess, want to say that this doesn't make Britain so much of a special case as Britain often like to think. In fact, I think it makes Britain a lot like the Europe that Britain might be voting to leave tonight. So I just want to say, that what does the study of referendums and voting behavior say? A couple of things. What does that tell us that we can learn from when we go through this night and when tomorrow morning we're trying to interpret what happened? So the first thing is, of course, that referendums are very unpredictable, and that's something that I'm sure David Cameron is acutely aware of tonight and probably starting to regret that he decided to call this referendum to sort of appease certain people within his own party. It was not only unpredictable in the sense that I think none of us in this panel, or indeed in this room, with any confidence can say what the outcome is going to be. I think we'd be fooling ourselves, or maybe we've had one too many beers if we're doing that. But I don't think we can do that. But also in the greater sense that you can have a government going out and saying you should vote Remain, and the main opposition party and the sort of major forces saying you should vote one way, and you can have the people turning the other way. And that's something we might be seeing tonight, and we'll certainly see a large proportion doing it, but it's also something we've seen in a number of other referendums. And one reason why that's the case is because referendums really give people, and also those people who feel disaffected, disenfranchised, unhappy with politics and the political chance, a chance to really stick it to that political class. So what often happens in referendum, even more than in election, is you're going to you have this divide, the people versus the elite. And I think the Leave campaign has played on that very cleverly, and we've seen that in other EU referendum, that they represent ordinary people. And if you look at survey evidence, you know, there's really a majority thinking that somehow the Leave campaign does represent ordinary people much better than does the Remain side. And also, it's not hard to portray the EU rightly as an elite invention. That's exactly what it was. So this taking back control is not just about the EU, but also taking back control from the political classes, the elites, and especially amongst these people who feel they've somehow lost out. So I think that's also a divide we've seen here very starkly, but that we see in referendums more generally. And we also shouldn't ignore the fact that referendums, some will vote about the EU, many will vote on immigration and the economy, but it's also just an opportunity to vote against what you don't like, against David Cameron if you don't like him, and so on. The third and final thing that this referendum does with referendums tend to do is they simplify complex issues. So, of course, membership of the European Union is a very complex issue. It touches upon economic, political, identity issues, and so on. But what the key battleground in a campaign is really to try and say, what's the question really about? And I think in this referendum, more than almost any other that I've studied, these messages have really been very stark, very clear, and increasingly so as the campaign has gone on. It's been the risk of economic chaos following Brexit, which has been the message hammered home by the Remain side, versus the risk of immigrants, EU immigrants, flooding us and being a burden to public services. And that's really been clear. I mean, I've done a study of where I sort of invited a lot of open-ended responses across over 5,000 people, and it's interesting that it was that came through, that's what people thought about. There are other issues to do with the European Union that you can be critical of, or like, you know, democracy, how we, you know, peace, security, a lot of issues, and they really didn't come through. So in that sense, the campaigns have managed to make that the two issues that people thought about. Now, which argument will win? I guess we'll know tomorrow morning. You know, are people more scared of economic chaos? Are they more scared of people like me flooding their borders? But either way, it's going to, especially in the event of Brexit, it's going to present the government and the parliament with a challenge tomorrow, and how to interpret that and how to go forward in terms of what kind of relationship Britain wants with Europe, whether in or outside, because this sort of Brexit fears of economic chaos versus immigration fears of flooding the borders is not going to give a lot of a mandate to establish a new or a continued relationship with the European Union.
Brilliant. Thanks very much.
Craig anticipated what you were going to say.
I'll talk about a few things. The first thing I'll say is, as part of the program with Anand and Matt and a few of us, have been up and down the country speaking at various public events. And it's been quite striking going to different communities in different parts of Britain. It made me realise I only ever leave Zone 3 to go to Heathrow and fly somewhere else. But it's the first time, actually, you get to go to places like Spalding in Lincolnshire or Canterbury, where we had that event in Canterbury. Or I spoke at a Skeptics in the Pub event in Lewes in Sussex, where I'm from. And one thing that's really striking is you actually get to... What was amazing to me was the vibrancy of the interest people really had in this. It fired up a lot of people. Regardless of the outcome of the referendum, I think there has been something positive about this campaign, and I don't mean the people running the campaigns, I mean the engagement of the public. And I think, you know, people have thought about some really serious issues in this campaign. They've thought about their identity. They've thought about our relations with Europe. They've probably learned something about the European institutions, about what is the single market. Suddenly, you know, you've got the newspapers, tabloid newspapers, talking about the single market and what the single market represents. And we've learned about, you know, free movement of people and what that means. And I think that we can take that away. The other really healthy thing, I actually think, is we've had a serious debate about immigration, which has meant that this has been an issue bubbling around in British politics for a long time. You've got political parties who've not really talked about it, they've tried to keep it off the agenda because they know it's a difficult issue, both for the Conservatives and for Labour. For the Conservatives, it's largely because they've got a lot of rural, older voters who don't like the fact that immigration means you've got cultural change in the country. And for Labour, it's actually a festering sore for a lot of Labour MPs in the north of England. When Matt and I and various others have talked to Labour MPs during this campaign, one of the things they've said to us is, we don't really want to campaign. We don't want to go on our doorsteps. In my constituency in Chester or my constituency in Sheffield, I'm going door to door. All they want to talk about on the doorstep is immigration, immigration, immigration. Mm. And when we go to places like Spalding, it's very easier here in London as, you know, cosmopolitan elites. It means we have cheaper nannies and cheaper cleaners and cheaper builders and cheaper plumbers and God knows what else we have and you know, a very vibrant city that we live. But when you go to places like Spalding in Lincolnshire, you realise that, yes, on aggregate, there, of course, is huge benefits to the British economy and British society of a very open immigration policy, but it has big distributional consequences that we've not discussed. And what are these distributional consequences? These consequences are things like the fact that there has been much higher competition in certain sectors of the economy. For example, agricultural labour. We heard in Spalding, in Lincolnshire, the price of agricultural labour has fallen over the last few years because of mass immigration. We heard that there's longer waiting lists for council houses, that there's no places in the primary schools. And we're then left on the platform having to say things like, that's not migrants' faults, that's the government's fault for not spending money on primary schools, for not clamping down on unscrupulous employers, for not spending money on more doctors in the NHS, for not building more houses. But it has, I think, led, whatever happens in the outcome of this debate, even if we vote to leave the EU, we'll still be a very high immigrant society. And the Leave campaign, I think, has been very misleading because last year's figures for 2015, we had net immigration into the UK from outside the EU of 180,000 and net immigration from inside the EU of 170,000. So even if they introduced their Australian point system and you brought those EU numbers down to maybe 100,000, you still got net immigration into the UK outside the EU of a city the size of Newcastle every year. So, you know, this fundamentally changes the country. We've not really debated these things, and I think that has been quite healthy. Now I'll say a little bit about the campaign itself. And I think we saw a few weeks ago Leave starting to gain in the polls after the period of PIRDA began. PIRDA is the period where the government can no longer spend money on the Treasury issuing reports saying things like it's going to cost every family £4,500 if we leave the EU. From the beginning of that period, we then started to see the Leave campaign start to go up and the Remain campaign remain flat and Don't Know is breaking for Leave. And part of this, looking at this, was you saw Gove and Johnson in particular, I think, looking like more optimistic, painting a narrative of Britain outside the EU, a more optimistic, open to the world, liberal, progressive. And this, I think, was against the narrative of Farage, which was essentially a little England, rolling the clock back, controlling our borders. And you saw these competing narratives within the Leave campaign. And then you had Farage's poster last Friday. And all of a sudden, that more liberal, progressive narrative within the Leave campaign started to collapse. And you saw several prominent politicians, people like Baroness Wasi, suddenly say, I can't associate myself with these guys. I was in favour of Leave as a kind of progressive vision of Britain outside the EU. Now it doesn't look like the Leave campaign is a progressive vision outside the EU. And I think if we see at the end of tonight that the Remain campaign has won this and we vote to remain in the EU, I think that Farage poster just happened to be on the day, of course, that we had the terrible murder of Joe Cox. But that Farage poster could be the Neil Kinnock Sheffield rally moment. Mm. So I don't know if foreign correspondents will remember that, but in Britain in the 92 election, week before the election, Labour had a victory rally in Sheffield. And everyone went, they haven't won the election yet. And it looked terrible that they were kind of presuming that the British public was going to vote for them, and then their vote collapsed in the last week of the campaign. So it could be that that Farage poster could be their equivalent of the moment where suddenly it mobilised all of the more liberal, progressive people who were not sure about which way to go in this, suddenly to go against the Leave because they saw this as more retrograde, the nasty guys, and the Remain guys to be the more nice, progressive guys. Yeah.
Great, great, fantastic. This is really good because they're moving along fast. We've got some stewards. Stewie, hands up for people with microphones. Do you have microphones? Anybody here with microphones? Right, get ready. I'm going to ask each of you, very quick, who do you call it for, and what's the... No, you have to do it, Matt, you have to do it. It's not that slightly patronising academic laugh. And what's the smartest thing each side did? Matt first.
Okay. Sure, I'm going to... on the condition that nobody tweets about this... And associates me with this prediction. I'm going to call this by 2 points for Remain, and that's going to come back and haunt me. And I'm going to say the smartest thing the smartest thing Remain did.
Oh. Okay, that's a good answer. Smartest thing.
my own view, awful campaign, got the narrative wrong. All of our research, I mean, Simon was involved with the experiment, we found making the positive case for the EU really makes a difference with Remain voters. Making the negative case for Brexit, well, you give up the argument. You go to buy a new car, do you want to hear about what's wrong with your old car, or do you want to hear about what's right with your new car? You want to hear about the new car, the new shiny thing. And unfortunately, Remain never did that. The smartest thing that the Leave camp did, people would disagree with me, but from a purely pragmatic point and political strategy, they focused on immigration. They doubled down on immigration, and that coincided with their rise in the polls.
Right, okay, the lights guy doesn't agree. He must be a secret Brexit guy. Very interesting on that. Of course, it's very hard to undo years and years of anti-EU propaganda, come all nice in January about how positive
that's the
EU
point.
Is.
That's exactly the point. In Britain, we've had 40 years of Eurosceptic media coverage. So if you give voters a pro-EU message...
They've never heard it before.
Exactly. So, I mean, it's just a reaction about how Osborne and Cameron, who are temperamentally sort of Englishy guys, did it. Sarah. Smartest thing and call it.
Well, the smartest thing, I think this, I agree that the smartest thing the Leave campaign did was to focus on immigration, but one more thing was to link it to what all British people love, which is the NHS. Yeah. I would say it's quite a tenuous link, but doing that was very clever, saying not only immigration, but also look what it's doing to our health services, and linking it to public services in that way, I think, was clever. The Remain side, I think they should have, I mean, I think they've been right in pointing out the economic cost of a Brexit. I think that was smart, but it wasn't enough. But I think, had they not done that, I think they'll have voted. I mean, I don't agree that doing that would have, that they should have entirely ignored that. I think that was the smartest thing they did, but probably not enough. And no, I'm absolutely not going to call it.
You're not going to call it. You're simply refusing the authority of the chair.
If I had to call it,
No,
we're not going to get into a squabble here, guys, but you're not calling it. You're not calling it. Simon, smartest and call.
The only thing I can do is go with the average of the polls in the last 48 hours, which is 52-48. I mean, that's...
Right. For Remain. And smartest on each side, very quickly?
I won't say the smartest. The dumbest thing was just to think that they could win it on economic risk. I mean, what was amazing in a YouGov poll 2 days ago was 70% of people who said they were going to vote Leave were saying they expected to be worse off economically. That just shows you how... relying on economic risk to win it is not going to win it for you in this kind of campaign.
Yeah, but immigration being the smart one for...
Immigration being absolutely the smart one.
Transformative, yeah. Good, guys, we've got a hand very quickly up, left hand, coming down to you. This really needs to borrow from the discipline of the panel and be short. Do say who you are if you belong to a group or something. Wait a sec, is there anybody else catching my eye over here? Anybody else over here? Anyway, go ahead.
Karina Robinson, governor of the LSE and alumni. This is really for Simon Hicks, which is what you said about sort of Sheffield moment, that immigration poster. Don't you really think it was Joe Cox's death at the hands of somebody who, made some comments that haven't yet been, fully verified?
Thank you very much. Can we see if there's anybody else wants to catch my eye before we go to this? Opportunity. Am I missing? I've got a hand pointing to another hand. Can you shout at what hand it is, sir?
Back to the left. back left. God, fantastic. I'm sorry for missing you. And there's another hand up here. Great. We'll take you three, and then we'll come to the panel. Yes, name and very quick question. Simon, you've got that one, haven't you?
Michael Mashinsky. I ran the student union, won the election here 30 years ago. But one thing that hasn't come out from the discussion is this issue, I think, of the elite versus the public. And I think that's going to be very telling. And for what it's worth, my prediction is a 52 to 53% leave vote this evening.
Huh. Okay, got it. And finally, on this wave...
Yeah, just one of the things I've observed in...
name, just quickly.
Sorry, Lauren Gerlach, I'm an alumnus. One of the problems the Republicans have had in the U.S. is they only know what they're against on Obamacare. They've never explained what they're for, and it seems to me a huge weakness of the Leave campaign. What the hell are they for? They say they want an association agreement, they want control of immigration. My sense is that the undecideds are going to pull for the status quo, because when you can only explain what you're against, you can win protest votes, you can win by-elections, you can win midterms, but it's really hard to win the main events.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot. Simon, should we start with you? It's a couple of you, and then generally, and then we'll run around. We'll have time for some more.
I'm a bit reluctant to point to the Cox murder. I think it definitely... brought home to a lot of people that not all politicians are venal, nasty, self-interested, liars. And I think it raised a big question for a lot of people in the country to say, wait a minute, there are a lot of young politicians in this country who are not self-interested, who do this because they are committed public servants, they're committed to doing good things. And I think if that then changes the nature of the campaign, it gets people to say, maybe... the politicians and the experts who are telling us to stay in, maybe they're not all just doing it because they're self-interested. And it did, in a sense, start to I think in combination with the poster, it started to, I don't know if it was just a few days and it might have gone away, but it definitely felt for a few days that the Remain guys suddenly were the nice guys and the Leave guys were suddenly the nasty guys. And it was that kind of feeling over the weekend that I think led Baroness Wasi on the Monday morning to then come out and say, I can't go with these guys. I really can't. I'm with the good guys on this one. And you know, so in hindsight, but it's hard to know how long that lasts. What was interesting in the polls is it didn't look like there was much of a bump in the polls. When the polls started polling again this week, we were back to level pegging exactly as we were just before the event.
Thank you. Sarah, do you want to come in?
I think I did mention, and I agree that the elite versus the masses or the people is really core to this. And that the Leave campaign has been quite successful in portraying their side as the one that represents the interests and the concerns of ordinary people, whereas the Remain side is out of touch. And I think that's key to how well they're doing and will be doing in this referendum. In terms of the Leave side not standing for anything, I mean, I think you could certainly make the same claim even more so about the Remain side. What do they stand for? I mean, they've said it's going to be bad to leave economically, to leave the European Union, but not really said anything about what is good or what they want from EU membership sort of. So the Leave campaign, you know, want to have Britain as a great, independent, great Britain again.
Take back control.
So I think you could say the positive vision has not been there a lot, but they certainly don't agree, but I think the positive vision has been lacking, if anything, even more on the Remain side than on the Leave side.
I agree with that.
All
right.
Good. Matt, thank you.
Yeah,
Sarah.
Well, first of all, I have a bone to pick with Frode, whoever you are, Frode or Frode, because you're out there sharing my prediction with the world, so you need to leave immediately, wherever
right,
you are.
Right, Frode, why didn't you tweet are. That?
That's outrageous. On the elite public disconnect, you know, here's a question we might be asking tomorrow, right? Let's just sort of suspend perhaps our take on the polls. Let's imagine Brexit happens over the next few hours and that's what we're left with in the morning. You know, I think Jeremy Corbyn will be immediately under the spotlight, because when it comes to the elite, you know, where's the Labour Party in this referendum? Alan Johnson, who I interviewed at the very beginning of this campaign, I remember at Chatham House, turned up full of energy, full of enthusiasm. This was it, the return of Alan Johnson, the man who can never summon the courage to take on the leadership of the Labour Party, but he was back. But where did he go? He completely disappeared, and the Labour Party were not visible, and then came the reluctant passenger, Jeremy Corbyn, who could not put out a passionate, convincing, compelling and clear message to, crucially, pro-EU Labour progressives who need to turn out. And even a few weeks ago, Just look at the data, the YouGov data. 1 in 2 Labour voters said they did not know where the Labour Party stood on this issue. The Labour Party that wanted to take Britain into the Euro, the party of Tony Blair, the party of Peter Mandelson, and half of their electorate did not know where the Labour Party stood on this issue. That, I think, is a damning indictment, in a way, of Jeremy Corbyn's position during this referendum. And, you know, the other thing, more generally, that never materialised at this vote was left-wing Euroscepticism. A year ago, we were talking about Owen Jones, Paul Mason, the critique of how the EU treated Greece and TTIP and the democratic deficit. Where did it go? It didn't materialise. Left-wing Euroscepticism in Britain, non-existent.
Yeah. Yeah. Alan, scared, the left-wing case against Europe's coming up in this place at about 11 o'clock. We have time for another round. We have a lady who's got her hand up with great decisiveness, promising and standing up. And you're going to be quite short, he said, warning you. Name and question. And yes. We're looking for two. We've got two in a row. Excellent. So we've got three. Yes, madam, okay. Go.
Valerie Tort, I'm a foreign correspondent. What does the panel think? Wasn't it a strategic mistake from David Cameron to allow the members of his cabinet to campaign against him and against Remain?
Thank you. Very succinct and very interesting. And now, yes, name. No, I know you, but name. It's just behind you for now. Sorry. Go.
Valtra Shake, the European Institute. What should the Remain campaign, it's a question to the panel, what should the Remain campaign have been made as the positive case? I mean, it seems to me there is a difficulty that defending the status quo is always more difficult than promising milk and honey and control as the Leave campaign did.
And, yes, just in front of you, brilliant, thanks. Now your chance. You were about to stand up. Do you want to do it now anyway?
Thank you. My name is Ingrid. I'm an undergraduate student at LSE. And my question regards the position of the rest of the EU and especially the representation of the European Commission on Smith Square that decided at the beginning of the referendum campaign to remain completely neutral. Was that a correct decision? Should the EU have campaigned better because Britain's exit affects its own future?
Brilliant, thank you. Congratulations on this succinctness. That's a great tone for the next 5 hours. Simon.
The EU should have campaigned for Leave, perhaps. I really think it was a wise idea staying out of it. Whatever they were going to say was going to be taken badly. In terms of the... I'll answer... Maybe Matt or Sarah can talk about the cabinet. But Labour tried at least a little bit to make a positive case. What was striking to me, actually, is that the only prominent politician in Britain making a positive case for Europe was Nicola Sturgeon. I mean, Nicola Sturgeon came down and did a speech in London that said... we believe in Scotland that the EU makes us safer, wealthier, freer, and happier. And I was like, I did a double take and thought, is that a British politician saying this about the EU? And Labour then started a little bit to make a case about environmental standards, labour protection, women's equality rights, and so on. But what we didn't hear was a conservative pro-European case for Europe that could have been articulated around the single market is a great thing. The single market is an incredible historic achievement for the free movement of goods, services, capital and labour in a market of 500 million people. It's a unique achievement. Every other region in the world would love to have what we have and they don't. And we didn't hear anything like that. And there's something qualitatively different between a single market and free trade. Free trade is just trade in a subset of goods, not really services because it's rarely... That's something fundamentally different to the complete removal of barriers to the free movement of goods, services, capital, and labour. They should have called me.
Should have called me.
Sarah, I think we'll keep the same order. Sarah and then Matt, and I think then we're going to wrap up. So, Sarah.
I mean, I think it might be harder to argue for status quo, but I think a positive case can be made. I think, for example, Gordon Brown tried to make one when he did his speech here at the LSE, and I think did so from his perspective, you know, powerfully. So I think that can be made. I think the Conservative Party, if we've probably almost forgotten by now that David Cameron renegotiated some deal because they very quickly realized that was not going to be the winning way of winning, so ignored that altogether. But if you remember the interviews leading up to that deal, basically Osborne, for example, went out to say he wasn't sure which way he would vote in the referendum. It all depended on the deal. So once you have set it up like that, it's almost impossible then to go back and say, actually, the European Union as such is a good thing. So they had painted themselves into a corner where it was almost impossible for the Conservative Party to make a positive case, and I think they didn't. I don't think Cameron had much choice on whether or not to let his cabinet members campaign. I mean, they were going to campaign for leave either way. They might have just have resigned. And I think the whole reason for calling this referendum was, of course, to try and keep his party together. Whether he succeeded in that, we'll see.
Matt, you might have to go. And people are going to be coming and going all evening. Do you have time just...
Do you want me to go right now?
No. No. Yes. I got a hashtag message, get that fellow off stage, and I follow everything. But Simon said you may have to go.
Can I say something before
absolutely,
I get looked
at? Absolutely. Okay. No, I was being polite, not rude.
Okay. So one thing that came to mind there. I don't do this often, but I do want to say something in defence of the politicians during the referendum campaign, because we do also have to remember that Europe is not a traditional issue, right? Europe is a complicated issue to navigate, and immigration is also incredibly complicated, because for both Labour and the Conservatives, it cuts right across their core electorate, right? 35% of Labour voters, if you believe the latest polls, have already gone out to vote for Brexit, right? 60% of Conservative Party members are going Brexit, 40% of Conservative Party members are wanting to stay in, and the Conservative Party electorate is divided right down the middle. That's a really difficult strategic dilemma that you've got to overcome as a politician. Really, really difficult. And I do think, you know, we forget. It's very easy to be critical. It's very easy to say, well, they didn't do the right thing here, they didn't do the right thing there. You know, you are dealing with a really tricky dilemma. But, you know, the only party that has not been dealing with a tricky dilemma, with the exception maybe of the Liberal Democrats, who are sort of fighting their own battle, were UKIP. Yeah. And the UK Independence Party, you know, more or less completely united in terms of infrastructure, in terms of leadership and voters on this question, with the exception of the 5% of UKIP voters in opinion polls who say they don't want to leave the EU. I never quite understand who they are or what they're doing, but there you are, they're out there. And I had a really interesting interview with a very prominent UKIP donor about 2 months ago, and I said, what will you do if Remain wins and squeaks this thing by 2 or 3 points? What happens to UKIP? What happens to the populist right in Britain? And the answer was, well, we rebrand. Right? I said, well, what does that mean? He said, we go from being a 10 to 15% political movement into a 15 to 25% political movement, because we're looking at what Geert Wilders is doing in the Netherlands, yeah, and what Five Star are doing in Italy. Did anybody see those local elections this week? Right? Or we're looking at what the Alternative for Germany are doing. And there is a clear appetite within the Eurosceptic right, irrespective of the result tonight, to continue that battle against Westminster elites. And it will predominantly, if I were to, you know, having to be providing a guesstimate, it will be predominantly framed around immigration, more so than the EU. And that, I think, is something that we can say with some certainty.
We're beginning to move on to the Sky moment. Can I ask you a question? It permits of a simple one-word answer, yes or no. And foreign press, this is an English term, it's is somebody toast, means are they finished. Is David Cameron, whatever the result, toast?
Well, he has said he'll stand down, by 2020. So, I mean, depending
by
on the margin.
By the end of the year.
Depending on the margin.
By the end of the year.
By the end of the year, if Remain win, no.
You're not allowed to sit on the fence. Is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom finished, whatever the result?
He won't stand down this year, this week or this month.
So the answer is no, he's not finished. Simon.
No.
Good. Look, we're moving around. They're going. Simon, you're staying on the stage, I think. Thank you to Matt and Sarah. We're getting them off the stage, and we're bringing up Tony. Are you here, Tony? Yeah, good. We have time. Good. All right, that's enough. That's enough. We're bringing up Tony, if he's here. We're bringing up Patrick, and we're bringing up Sue. Sue, are you here? Brilliant. And we've also got Tim. Tim, are you here? Brilliant. Tim from QM is new to the list.
The regional count in Leeds. Mike.
Here we are. And Tony, you're taking over now. Yeah.
Yes, welcome to Leeds and the first direct arena in the city centre, where 490 counters are preparing for what is likely to be a very long night. A long night because Leeds is one of the later local areas which will make its declaration out of all 21 local declarations that are being covered and fed into this particular spot tonight. Now, this, as you say, is the regional hub for Yorkshire and Humber. So when they've got all of those 21 results ending with Leeds, then they'll make the overall declaration, which will be fed in turn to Manchester and the national vote. Now, one of the things that's going to slightly delay proceedings here this evening is at 11:30, Leeds and many of the other 21 local counties in the Yorkshire and Humber region will be observing a minute's silence in memory of the late MP Jo Cox, who was killed in her constituency last week, very close to Leeds, in the town of Birchcote. So that will happen at 11:30.
Of course, I forget that 5 minutes is quite a long time.
It is. They'll look like they'll all be looking like spare parts.
Good evening from the Emirates Arena in Glasgow. Just a short hop, skip and a jump away from the Sir Chris Hoyne Velodrome. And you've got to say, at times it does feel like the electoral cycle here in Scotland has been going almost as fast as the great man himself. This will, of course, be the fourth major political event to have happened in Scotland over the last 18 months. We had, of course, the Scottish independence referendum, then the general election, followed by elections to the Scottish Parliament, and now a vote on continued membership of the European Union. We had a little bit earlier from the Electoral Commission. Roughly 4 million votes could be cast here in Scotland. In fact, exactly 3,986,898, 450,000 votes potentially could be getting counted behind me here in Glasgow. We'll be monitoring all 32 of those unitary authorities that will be returning results tonight, paying particular attention, of course, to those bigger metropolitan areas, Edinburgh, for example, Aberdeen, Aberdeenshire, Dundee, Fife, where the numbers really are stacking up. In terms of what we're expecting here in Glasgow tonight, well, we'll be getting an idea of turnout, we believe, at around 1 in the morning, and despite predictions before that we could be here as late as 5 in the morning for a result, we're hearing that potentially that could be coming in at around 3. The whole of it's Scotland not being collated here, but elsewhere in Falkirk, we'll bring you all the results.
Well, I'm in the district of Tendring in the county of Essex. We're at the count in Clacton. Population here around 55,000 people. It's known as a seaside resort. And that figure, 55,000, feeding into that more than 111,000 people who are eligible to vote in this district. We're in the eastern region, which ranges from Basildon to Wavy, quite a large area, about 47 counts there are in this region here tonight. And once the votes are collated, they will be sent along to the regional count, which is in Chelmsford. Now, we are being told that because of the weather, the bad weather that has been occurring today, that the actual boxes coming in will be late. So the prediction of a 4 a.m. count and declaration probably won't happen, and that time will be pushed forward.
Welcome to Belfast and the vast Titanic Exhibition Centre, part of the site where the historic HMS Titanic was designed and built. Normally this is the site for travel exhibitions and car shows, but tonight it's where the counting officer will announce the official result for the Northern Ireland voting area. It's the biggest counting area in the UK, with 1.25 million people eligible to vote. And although it's classified as a single counting area, there are actually 8 different venues around the province where counting is taking place. And here they're going to adjudicate and verify and collate them. And they're also doing a bit of counting of their own. They're actually tossing up the votes from the Belfast area too. And they've got a little bit of musical accompaniment because there's a live concert going on just over the road, which has provided them with a bit of entertainment while they work. We're expecting counting to get underway as soon as the polls close at 10. First provisional result should come in about midnight or so, but we're not going to get that official result for the whole Northern Ireland region till about 4 or 5 in the morning.
Anna, thank you very much indeed. Well, record numbers of people eligible to vote today. We don't know how many of them have voted. That included citizens of the UK, of Ireland and of the Commonwealth. Who have been resident here, not European citizens.
However. Okay, all right,
So across the country,
we have the
UK,
we have the sound up.
Europe in Gibraltar, thousands of election officials are waiting to count the ballots. The close of polls is now just moments.
Well, I think so. We need to get everybody back in their seat. We're going to take this programme straight after at 10 and immediately afterwards in order to get the YouGov poll, which we're assuming is going to be near the top of the programme. If it isn't, you're going to be hearing a lot of me saying it's about to be at the top of the programme. So if we could sort of gradually make your way back to your seats. What we're then going to do is, after that, Simon and I are going to talk about what will go on during the night, what we can expect, and then we'll turn to a second panel, which is going to look at the impact of all of this on British politics. So the polls are about to close any second now, imminently, as it says on this screen. And according to...
I'm going to put...
The sound is going to come back on.
Closed in the UK's historic referendum on EU membership. By breakfast tomorrow, we should know whether Britain is staying in or leaving the European Union. Tonight on Decision Time, the most important political decision the UK will make for decades. We'll be bringing you results and analysis from counts across the country, live and uninterrupted. Sky News has cameras from the Orkney Islands north of Scotland to Gibraltar on the southern tip of Europe. And immediately, breaking news. Let's get the assessment of our political editor, Faisal Islam, who is in Downing Street tonight. Of course, Faisal, not a vote has been counted yet, but got some surprising indications of how people think things are going to go.
Yeah, take this with a pinch of salt, but we have had, we've spoken to Nigel Farage, the leader of UKIP, heavily connected not with the official Leave campaign, but the other Leave campaign, Leave.eu. He's given us this statement as the polls close. It's been an extraordinary referendum campaign. This is Nigel Farage. Turnout looks to be exceptionally high and looks like Remain will edge it. UKIP and I are going nowhere and the party will only continue to grow stronger in the future. So that's it. I mean, it's not quite a concession. As I said, I don't just put a pinch of salt on that. I put a giant vat of salt on that. My understanding is that Leave.eu have commissioned a 10,000-person poll, and that is informing Nigel Farage's view that Remain will edge it. Okay, so let's park that for a minute. Other private polls have been issued too, and we'll be hearing our own hopefully quite soon. What we do know from all sides is they're expecting turnout to be huge, potentially bigger than a general election. People are talking about 70%. There were long queues outside polling stations in areas where both the Remain vote is strong and the Leave vote is strong too. One cabinet minister telling me that in Labour areas in his ward, obviously a Conservative MP, turnout is extraordinary in those working class Labour areas. That's not necessarily good for the Labour choice of Remain. It might be in those working class areas that that's the Labour vote coming out for Leave. But a high turnout, we think, could benefit Remain. And right now, the cautiously optimistic voices are on the Remain side of the equation. The more pessimistic voices are on the Leave side of the equation. But the bigger picture is all of this, the detail really matters. So we're making no predictions, no projections, but Nigel Farage sounding rather pessimistic.
OK, Faisal, we shall see, because the important thing to remember is that tonight, unlike at a general election, there is no broadcaster's exit poll, and that's because our experts in polling say that the model used by Sky News, the BBC and ITV at general elections can't be applied to a one-off event like this referendum because there's simply no pattern on how people have voted. However, the online pollster YouGov has been busy throughout today questioning nearly 5,000 people on how they voted. And these, I believe, are people who they had previously questioned as to their voting intention. YouGov's Joe Twyman is with me now. So, Joe, tell us about it and what the result is.
Well, as you say, today YouGov went back to the people that we previously spoken to yesterday to see if there had been a change.
And just remind ourselves, the last poll you had was Remain 51% and Leave 49%.
Yes, and so we're interested to see if there had been a change on the day. There has been a small change, and based on that, We now expect that the United Kingdom will remain part of the European Union. Now, it's 52% remain, 48% leave. So it's still close, and it's still too early to know definitely.
Well, give it,
but
just give it,
based on Sarah, the figures that we're seeing, based on the trends that have occurred, and based on historical precedent, we think the Remainer are in the strongest position.
I mean, it has to be said, if it were to be 52-48, I mean, if you'd taken an average of the polls throughout the campaign, that would be pretty close to it, wouldn't it?
Well, it shows that, that there's been a lot of movement along the way, and the campaign has seen a lot of movements in line with what we saw actually in Scotland. This move towards the new option, and then a move back towards the status quo.
Now, we were hearing there from UKIP. We don't know who conducted their opinion poll for them.
OK, now we're going to go back into the main programme. What's going to happen is that for the next 5 or 10 minutes, Simon and I, you've met Simon before. By the way, Simon was predicting, without the massive poll earlier on, that the result would be 52-48. So, an oracle indeed. Anyway, we're now going to explain what to expect during the night. That's between now and effectively 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning. And this is really just a sort of mixture of civics and what will finally happen with some of the declarations. So let's just start. The referendum electorate. It's broadly UK citizens and Irish citizens, Commonwealth citizens, but not, as we all know, EU citizens. They had to be registered by the 23rd of June 2016. We can talk out of this big meeting about why Commonwealth citizens are in this particular electorate and EU citizens aren't. For those of you who haven't voted today, this is the ballot paper that those of us who have witnessed today, that's it, nice and simple, Remain top, Leave second. Studies about whether that has an effect. The count. Now, the polls have just shut, so 10 o'clock, 10 p.m, an hour earlier in Gibraltar, mustn't forget Gibraltar, and the ballot boxes now have to be transferred to 382 local authority counting points. This result is not counted by constituency, but by local authority area. The total electorate, confirmed earlier this week, 46,499,537. So if the turnout is 66 to 68%, it'll be a bit higher than that apparently, we're talking about more than 30 million votes counted by hand. Starting now, there will be people running with ballot boxes in Sunderland and Newcastle to get there with the count first, because they see it as a matter of pride to have the first declaration. Counting areas vary enormously in size. As Connor said, he's looking forward to the Isles of Scilly results. And there are 1,700 people who live there, but in Birmingham, it's an electorate of 700,000. And, of course, the physical geographical area of these places varies enormously as well. What will happen is the local results in each local council area will be declared by each authority, local authority, after they've been endorsed by a regional counting officer. There's one for each region and nation inside the United Kingdom. The regional totals, which will eventually be announced themselves, will then be communicated to the chief counting officer, Jenny Watson, and the final result declared 7 to 8 o'clock in the morning at Manchester Town Hall. This is part of the government's Northern Powerhouse policy to have the announcement made in the north, which is probably where you should all have been. Anyway, there is no provision for a national recount. Individual counts by authority could be challenged at that point, but once they've been endorsed and agreed, added together, there's no provision for a national recount. This, for those of you who are from overseas, is what a British count looks like in sports halls or schools,
but
not unique to this country.
They are really doing it over there.
Yeah, that's exactly, isn't it? Isn't that well timed? They're running, as I said they would. They've been running. This is actually in Sunderland in the general election, and these are the tellers, the various parties in a general election. It'll be Leave and Remain tonight, watching what is going on to check that the bundles are appropriately counted. I'm going to hand over to Simon in a minute, but just to say, we're expecting the first results to come in at around 12:30. It's possible Gibraltar or the Scillies will come in first, but Sunderland, probably about 12:30, followed soon by Newcastle-upon-Tyne, its near neighbour, Wandsworth in London, and the City of London, another small authority. From about 2 o'clock, there are expected to be larger numbers of declarations coming in with a steady number all the way through till about 5 a.m. thereafter, a smaller number from rural areas. This will have the effect that the Remain vote will look slightly higher than it should do earlier on, because it's from urban areas, so it may do. And when the rural ones come in later, Leave may start to catch up as we add them up, or as they add them up at the TV stations. The regional declarations will be declared later in the night, and then, as I say, the national declaration in Manchester early in the morning. This is Manchester Town Hall, a Victorian Gothic epic, often used because it's very like it inside on TV and radio to play the Palace of Westminster, which was built at nearly the same time. Now I'm going to hand over to Simon to explain these excellent and very helpful tables.
So we've put this together from Chris Hanretti, who's a political scientist at University of East Anglia, and Ron Johnson, who's a political geographer at Bristol. They each had forecasts of what would happen in each local authority based on British election study, polling data, census data, various models they built, and then they were aggregated together to look at some of the early local authorities that will be announced, starting with everyone expects Sunderland to be first. This is the average prediction between these two polls of what they expect. If it's a 50-50 result nationally, Sunderland would be 46 Remain, 54 Leave. So Sunderland, northeast of England, working class area, industrial decline in parts of the city, but also Nissan factory, and Nissan been pushing its workers to vote for Remain. So if Sunderland comes out with a majority for Remain, that's a very good indicator for Remain. If Sunderland comes out with a 10-point gap or larger for Leave, that's very good for Leave. Wandsworth, one of the other ones, expecting to declare early. By the way, the declaration times are from the Electoral Commission, asked all the returning officers in every local council to give them an estimated time when they would be declaring, and we compiled this from some of the early ones that will be coming in that will be some of the interesting ones. So Wandsworth, southwest London, conservative constituency, very upper middle class, expecting to be very cosmopolitan, expecting to be strongly for Remain. You can see down here some of the Swindon will be interesting, Oldham, Stockport in Manchester, expected to be neck and neck. So if Stockport comes out strongly one way or the other, again, that will be an interesting indicator. We've got Merthyr Tydfil here from Wales, one of the poorest parts of the whole country, expected to be very, very strongly Leave, very solid Labour area, although Plaid, I think, picked it up in the Welsh Assembly elections. So back to you, okay, Tony. So write some of these numbers down and we can check them as we go through the night.
This is another set of... Now, Stockport appears in both. Simon pointed out that Stockport is 51-49 on this projected vote. And what we've done here is to list other places that declare relatively early. Here are the times in the second column. And these are all close to 50-50. So if the national result were 50-50, anywhere that shows up here as 50-50 is projected also to be 50-50. Consequently, if, say, Salford comes out one way or the other, and we'll have to, these are projected, you know, I mean, it's not absolutely precise, but any substantial numbers either side of these figures, and it would be good for the relevant side. So this is slightly easier in some ways to follow, though these will be declaring slightly later in the night, at least these at the bottom. But these should all be, most of these will be while we're here, crucially, before you all have to go off to other places. And we think we need to talk a bit in a moment or two. We're going to move on to our panel. But it seems to me that, or it seems to us, that there are these broad scenarios, if you can call them that, that there is the biggish win for Leave or Remain, what I've called stay here. So Leave or Remain. So anything above 55% for either of them, so actually slightly bigger than what we've just heard from YouGov and Simon Hicks. Then weak Leave or weak stay, that looks like where we're going to be between those two, or the technical very near dead heat. Now, I don't literally mean exactly the same number of votes, but, you know, 50.1 to 49.9, with all sorts of implications that that might bring with it. So I'm going to leave this slide here. We're now going to go to our panel for a few opening words, and then we're going to follow the pattern of Connor's earlier panel, though, of course, it will be slightly less amusing, I've no doubt, with him gone for the time being. But don't worry, he'll be back. That's a warning, not a threat. It's a threat and a warning, actually.
And that's
Simon,
me. Goodbye.
Thank you. Simon will be around all night. Okay. Now, I'm going to ask each of our distinguished panel, who I should introduce, by the way. And again, you've got their biographies in your packs. We have Tim Bale sitting nearest to me, who's Professor of Politics, Queen Mary University. Sue Cameron, who's a journalist, who's worked in a number of newspapers and TV and radio still over the years. And Patrick Dunleavy, Professor of Political Science and Public Policy here at the LSE. So I just want to ask you, as an opening gambit in each case, perhaps starting as you're nearest to me, Tim, if we are in somewhere between week leave and week remain, or week stay, as I've called it here, what's that going to tell us about what's just happened and what may be about to happen as the markets and the political system responds?
Well, I would say that if the poll that we've just seen, which isn't, of course, an exit poll, so we really do, as the journalist earlier said, have to take it with a pinch of salt, is anything like accurate, we are in a situation where I would have thought that the market certainly would respond very positively. A win is a win, even if it's a narrow win, as far as they're concerned. I think with regard to the Conservative Party and David Cameron, that, again, is the case. A win is a win, even if it's a fairly narrow win. I would expect David Cameron to be sleeping much more soundly on Friday evening than he will do perhaps tonight. I think there are 30 to 50 Conservative MPs who will still regard Mr. Cameron, their nominal leader, as effectively a traitor to the party and to his country. And I think they will be determined to make his life as difficult as possible over the next 2 or 3 years. And they will be perfectly able to do that, since the government now only has a majority of around 12 in the House of Commons. We have already seen over the last year how difficult it has been for the government to get some of its more controversial legislation through, and I would expect it to find it just as difficult to get some of the measures that are in its domestic programme through over the next 2 or 3 years. I would not expect, but I don't think that we can necessarily guarantee that this will be the case, a confidence vote in David Cameron. That would require 50 people to write to the chairman of the 1922 committee in Parliament and demand a vote of no confidence. I think there will be a lot of pressure, even on those Eurosceptic zealots, not to do that and to take a bit of a deep breath and allow David Cameron a little bit of time to conduct what I expect will be a reunification rather than a revenge reshuffle. It is not in David Cameron's nature, and it's not really David Cameron's modus operandi to do anything other than try and put his party together again. David Cameron is by nature someone who is a balancer, someone who is a broker, and to some extent, some of his enemies would say, on both sides of the party, a bit of an appeaser. So I would expect him to do absolutely everything he could to bring on board some of those with whom he has fallen out, perhaps quite badly, over the last few weeks. And yes, that would probably include Michael Gove, if he chooses to stay on. Michael Gove is a great advocate of the liberal justice reforms that David Cameron himself believes in, and I think Cameron will probably give him a chance to follow those through, despite some of the difficulties that there have been between Gove and the Prime Minister over the last few weeks. Then there's the question of what to do with Boris Johnson. We can discuss this perhaps at...
Let's ask Sue what to do with Boris Johnson
further length. I think David Cameron will seek to bring Boris Johnson into the tent. The question will be What job can he give Boris Johnson that Boris Johnson will accept and will think is worthy of his considerable talents and considerable ego? David Cameron, on the other hand, will want to give Boris Johnson, and certainly George Osborne will want to give Boris Johnson something that he may not actually make much of a success of. So the key...
Foreign Secretary, then.
Yeah, the Foreign Secretary...
Home Secretary?
Might... Well, I think Home Secretary is a good shout, as my daughter would say, Tony, because that is... Well, in charge of immigration, which will be tricky for Boris, and it's also, of course, normally the graveyard of political ambition in this country. I don't think he'd give him anything like health, because that's too... electorally sensitive, and if Boris were to mess that up, that could actually cause the Conservatives electoral problem. So he needs to give him something that's big enough for Boris to accept, but also something that Boris perhaps won't do that great a job in. That's the sweet spot, I suppose. Because I think it is still David Cameron's intention, if at all possible, to be succeeded by George Osborne or someone of that ilk. So I think for the Conservative Party, ironically, Brexit might have been the best option, because it would have solved the Conservative Party's problem on Europe, and perhaps I don't think this referendum will solve that. There will be, as I say, many Conservative MPs and many people in the Conservative Party who will, almost as soon as they wake up tomorrow and perhaps realise that they've lost this referendum, we'll be working out how to have a second referendum in as short a time as possible. And, of course, we will get a leadership contest by 2020, and you can guarantee that at that leadership contest, one of the first things the contestants will be asked is their view on holding a second referendum, and in that case, would they be recommending an outvote or an in-vote? I should just quickly say something about what if the polls are wrong? What if this poll is wrong? I still think that is entirely possible. I think wrote something in the autumn about prediction being a mug's game, and then I went ahead and predicted anyway, 47-53 in favour of Remain. My head still says, and especially after I've seen that, I suppose, says that's probably the more likely outcome. But I would not be at all surprised to wake up at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning and find that we have indeed left the European Union. So I don't think that we should immediately assume and frame our remarks, you know, throughout this discussion along the lines of, you know, why has Remain won and why has Leave lost, and what will happen now that Remain has won. I think it is still possible, and we ought to keep, I think, that prospect in play and until we've seen a few more results.
OK, Tim, very good. And in fact, it is an important corrective, because 52-48 is such a narrow projection, it is a projection, that we will be sitting watching the numbers pile up till very late into the night, even if it is to be 52-48. And David?
I interrupt, but it does seem to me that one can make a prediction very sharply now. Nigel, politicians don't give up easily. If Nigel is supposed to be 52-48, it must be a good deal more than that for Nigel Farage.
Okay, what a very interesting observation. Yes. David Butler, who wrote the definitive book about the 1975 referendum, reminds us that if Nigel Farage is slowly putting up a peace flag, or I'm not got a peace flag, it's not what I mean, is it, but a flag, that it perhaps means that he's a bit more certain than Tim is. But I do think Tim, nevertheless, is right to warn us off assuming too much too early. But thank you, David. Now, Sue, we've had Boris Johnson mentioned, and again, I'm not presuming what's going to happen in this, but some of these big creatures who are lining up for when David Cameron goes, which could be later this year, but certainly by 2020. I mean, either way round 52-48 either way, what does it tell us about that future for British politics and those people?
Well, I think I'd like to start with a sort of quite a general point, which is it seems to me that after what has very often been a disgraceful campaign on both sides, what all the parties have to do, including the Tories and David Cameron, but also Labour, the whole lot of them, is that they have to find a way to repair their relationship with British voters. Because I think, and particularly if it's very narrow, it seems to me that what the voters will be saying, to some extent at any rate, is a plague on all your houses. We don't know what the facts are. We don't know what to believe. And we are really, really unhappy. And it also seems to me that none of them, with, I'm afraid, the exception of Nigel Farage, are even addressing this issue properly yet. Farage, I gather, has been saying tonight that he is going to start a sort of slightly new version of his party on an anti-elitist, young people, social media basis, which suggests to me that he's rather ahead of the game in terms of taking a new look at where we all go from here. As far as the Tories go, if it's Remain, then obviously, as Tim says, Cameron will be sleeping a lot better. A win is a win, however small it is. But it seems to me that either way, it's going to be years, possibly, of attrition. Because if Cameron has won, even if he's won quite big, let alone if it's tiny, the outers are going to start immediately saying, we was robbed, we want another referendum. They are going to start trying to block him in the Commons on a whole load of different things. It's going to be really, really hard for him. And one of the first things they'll have to discuss, and they won't really know where they are on this, is whether to invoke Article 50 of the treaty, which gives you 2 years to work out a negotiation. Now, if it's leave, they will have to try and do that. But even if it's leave, it seems to me that there is still going to be a war of attrition, because the vast majority of MPs are going to be in favour of Remain, and so whatever any government tries to do, they will be blocking it. They will be saying, well, yes, of course, we want to do what the people want, but we can't accept this clause or that clause or the other clause or this way of doing it. And so Cameron is in. I don't think he's toast, by the way. I think, funnily enough, if it's just for leave, I think the outers will need him, if anything, more than ever, because they're completely confused as to what they want to do on immigration in real life, whether they want to be in the single market or not, and they are going to need Cameron to give themselves time to come to, not only to come to a decision on who would be the leader, but also to come to a decision as to what it is they want to do. So I think politics is in for a long, hard road, particularly Cameron. As for Labour, obviously Remain would be better for Corbyn, but Corbyn has not done well, I think, by anybody's standards. I think Labour won't do anything very much about Corbyn if it's Remain, because they will be enjoying the Tories' discomfiture too much. They'll want it to go on for a bit. If it's leave, then I would think he would be much more likely to go more quickly. But I think one of the crucial things there will be what Matt Goodwin mentioned. It'll be which Labour voters, or how many Labour voters, voted against Corbyn, in inverted commas, voted to leave rather than to remain. And if people inside the Labour Party are saying, look, we've seen what happened in Scotland when Labour just disappeared to the SNP. This could happen in England. We have to have a new leader to stop the rot now. So I think whatever the result, I think it's going to be a pretty bumpy ride for everybody from here on in.
Very good. Thanks. Now, Patrick, excellent. Sue mentioned not only the brutal nature of the campaign and the way it led both the government, as it were, to use its machine, and then the Leave camp, or the government and the Remain side, and then the Leave side to come up with some fairly exotic numbers as well. Both sides did this. But this has allowed, and Sue referred to this, a large number of people to vote together
in a way they'd never be able to in a general election, because they'd all be voting tactically in this constituency and that. So can you say something about this idea of effectively one great big constituency where people can express a view, which, as Sue says, is apparently a view about being left behind, whatever it is, articulating it, which Nigel Farage obviously is going to fight on with?
Okay, well, I mean, I'm the director of an NGO called Democratic Audit of the UK, and we spend a lot of our time systematically trying to advocate for democracy. And until quite recently, I've always been pretty sanguine about referenda. And I've always thought, well, a referendum is a good idea, and so on. If you have it on some particular issue, let's say the alternative vote referendum, which we had 4 years ago, it's a small issue, it's very specific, people get to chance, it's a chance for people to speak directly. Now, why hasn't this happened this time? Why has this referendum uniquely really begun to raise very serious doubts in many people's minds about the enduring quality of British democracy? And the answer is that democracy has got several things that you need to happen at once. Okay, it's majority rule, but if you just have majority rule on its own, and that sweeps aside everything else, that's very coercive. That's why plebiscites have been used by President Putin in Crimea or by Hitler in the 1930s. So, you know, a plebiscite on a really big issue that is irreversible, where you can't come back next time and change it round, where you've got massive numbers of issues all together, where there's no respect for the rights of minorities. And there isn't, really. If we had a leave vote, every one of you would lose all of your citizenship rights. Your children would lose it, your grandchildren would lose it, and so on. There's a fantastically coercive thing that David Cameron has engineered. And finally, of course, democracy entails, and this is very important in modern political theory, a commitment to deliberation, a commitment to trying to see the other person's point of view, to trying to work through and reach an accommodation, to try and get to a consensus outcome. Now, why haven't we been able to do that over the EU? Why is it that the only way the anti-EU lobby has found any chance at all of expressing their views, apart from European elections and midterm elections, is this forced referendum? And the answer is that we have a cabal of two main parties in Parliament, Labour and the Conservatives, who between them, over very many years, have always been split on this issue. At the moment, it's splitting the Tories more than Labour. But they are desperately concerned to try and maintain their own grip on power. So we don't have a representative system of election for the Commons. Nigel Farage, whatever else you may think of him, got 13% of the votes at the last general election, and for that, UKIP got one MP. Now, that is a travesty of democracy. That's the root of why we're having this fantastically coercive, fantastically regressive, fantastically unhelpful and undemocratic referendum process. Now, you can have a referendum on the different kinds of issues, tradable issues, issues you can come back to, issues that are very specific, and so on. But that's the real problem we've got here, and that's why people are saying things like, well, we haven't been given the facts, when they've been deluged with facts. But the point is, it's too complicated. It's a structural kind of once-in-a-lifetime issue, and you can't actually ask voters to make those issues. That's what you have representative democracy for, except that our representative democracy doesn't work. And the whole of the first panel, every speaker, thought it was perfectly okay to let party interests determine what should happen. Now, what's the end result of that? We've had a very divisive electoral referendum campaign. Whatever the result, whether it's a narrow win or a narrow for Remain or a narrow win for Leave, we end up with a divided country. We end up with the political elites looking unresponsive. We end up with the first political assassination for 25 years, which I don't think is a coincidence. I think it's been a product of a very fevered and unhelpful, unpublic interested process. So that's really where we are. Where does that leave David Cameron? Well, he's trying very hard to be the only British Prime Minister since Stanley Baldwin to leave office who is not an absolute failure in the eyes of his party, history and the people at large. And perhaps he'll do it. He'll be the guy who saved the union twice and who will bow out in a Stanley Baldwin-esque way in 2018, leaving Osborne to take over.
OK, very good. I'm going to open it up to questions in a moment. Stanley Baldwin, quite a lot of historical figures got to mention there. But it has been an incredibly brutal campaign. Sue and Patrick, you both, and Tim, all have referred to this. I'm going to open this up to the audience in a minute, but I just want to tease out, do you think on balance that really aggressive campaigning, the use of the government machine beyond what is normal by one side, the challenging of experts and the Treasury's expertise on the other, can that be put right? Or has it done, you know, like the MP's expenses scandal, some permanent damage? Sue, you brought this up.
I think two things. I think particularly if it's a Leave vote, by the way, I meant to say this earlier, one of the winners will be the civil service, because who else will the outers turn to for what do we do now, what works? And I think even if it is for Remain, I think there's going to be huge effort will have to be put in, whether they want to or not, to reform of our institutions here in the UK, as well, obviously, as reform of Europe. And I think, again, the civil service, I think old Jeremy Hayward won't do too badly out of all this. He's strong, and they'll need him. Just one thing I'd like to add to what Patrick was saying. It seems to me that an even worse abuse than the UKIP getting 4 million votes and one MP and the Scots Nats get 1.5 million votes and 56 MPs is that if there is a challenge to Cameron, the decision as to who the leader is, it will be winnowed down to two people, and then the voters will be 150,000 Tories in the country, less than 0.5% of the electorate. And I think that if that happens, there will really might actually be a revolt. I think an awful lot of people are saying this cannot happen. And it's the same with Labour. They've got a few thousand more, perhaps, but I think it's exactly the same. As far as the campaign goes, I don't think, I'm interested because I'm nerdy about the civil service, but I don't think the Purdah stuff really matters too much. I think it is the dishonesty. The dishonesty of the Treasury saying you will lose £4,300 a year when actually they're throwing it forward 15 years ahead when nobody can know, and the out-and-out lies told by some of the outers. And I think that is... I don't think people are going to get over it. I think people are going to absolutely demand, and probably in fairly short order, higher standards. And there will be a prize to be won for any politician who actually gets a grip on that and tries to do something about it.
I must say, I was struck myself just before Purdah, of all the many press releases the government put out, I was particularly heartened by the government says EU good for the gin industry on the Treasury website with a picture of a gin and tonic, no less. And I found that quite so strangely heartening. Anyway, Tim, do you want to add anything to what we've just heard?
Your turn. In some ways, one of the concerns I have, or, you know, some would say certainly if David's right, had about Brexit was that actually instead of helping people to realise that they have taken back control, it would eventuate in a situation where, in fact, the electorate in this country would have become even more disaffected and even more alienated from politics, because I simply do not believe myself that some of the promises that have been made to them by the Leave campaign in particular can possibly be delivered. I think, however, large numbers of people will have gone to the polls and voted to leave on the assumption, if that happens, that there would be more money to spend on the NHS, to spend on schools, to spend on farming, to spend on all the things that the Leave campaign say it could have been spent on, and would have gone to the polls thinking that in fairly short order, this country would be able to completely control its borders and prevent many more people coming in every year. I don't think either of those things could happen, can happen, and I think for the electorate to discover that I think would have been, or, you know, if Leave wins, which is still a possibility, would be almost catastrophic, actually, for our politics. So I think if we get a Remain result, obviously a lot of people will be disappointed, but I think that level of disappointment would be as nothing to how disappointed people would be when they find out, to be honest, that on the Leave side in particular, they would have been sold a pup. I mean, obviously one can criticise the Remain side as well, but I think partly because, of course, Remain was arguing generally for the status quo, I think far fewer outlandish promises were made. Having said that, of course, the government is still completely stuck with the ridiculous promise that it is aiming to reduce immigration from the hundreds of thousands to the tens of thousands. That it strikes me as one of the biggest albatrosses any political party has hung around its own neck in decades. It will be really, really fantastic, I think, for British politics if David Cameron and the Conservative Party were to actually level with people and to say that is a promise that we can't keep, an ambition that we cannot hope to meet, and therefore we have to be a little bit more honest about this. It would be great also, perhaps, if the Conservative Party were to level with people about Europe and the European Union. It would be great if Britain could become a more constructive force, perhaps, in EU affairs. I suspect, however, that if we have voted to remain, that none of that will be the case, because I suspect that David Cameron, unfortunately, this is his, again, modus operandi, will probably want to prove that he is more Eurosceptic than ever over the next few years. And I don't think we're going to get that kind of honest conversation with the electorate, which for me is a bit of a shame.
Okay, very good. And of course, one other thing, and I will now open this up to the question, one other thing we're going to discover, of course, is many of the things that Conservative people on the Leave campaign have been saying about the underfunding of the NHS and immigration will be used by the Labour Party and other opponents of the government for some time to come as research briefing material. But anyway, that's for the future. That also does presuppose we were to vote to stay. So, question here. I will take two or three, usual as Connor did, say roughly who you are and where you came from. Woman in the middle there, and I'll take a third. I'd like a third question before we start. Come on. Third. Can I see a third hand?
Person there.
Okay, very good. Okay, you're away.
Okay, I'm Nathan Charlton. I'm at the European Institute. I'm interested in, there seems to be a consensus amongst panellists that the Labour Party have had a bad campaign, but I'm interested in the idea that perhaps they've avoided some of the problems they came across in the Scottish referendum, where they aligned themselves far too closely with the status quo and suffered and allowed nationalists in Scotland. And potentially there's the potential for this consequence in the north of England as well for Labour. Would that not be perhaps a defence of their lacklustre campaign, if you like? Or...
Okay, good question. Labour problems? Yep, woman in the middle, yep.
Ellie Knott, I have the misfortune of just completing a PhD on Crimea. My question is about the international politics of referenda, because I think it's important to distinguish between the EU referendum that we're having today, where we agree on the rules of the game, it's not on the barrel of a gun, the question has been long debated and we kind of agree on the terms of the question, which I would argue is not the case for the Crimean referendum. So what is the kind of internal and international legitimacy then of the EU referendum? And I think the importance to distinguish between these kind of different types of referendum and the legitimacy that they might have.
Just to check I've got that, it's about the legitimacy of it, is that what?
I mean, I don't think we should be comparing the referendum that we're having today with the Crimean referendum, and I think they're very different in terms of the agreement on the rules of the game and the implications that has for the domestic.
Okay, well, Patrick can deal with that. And, yeah, gentleman in the middle.
My name is Samuel Johnson, and I'm a former president of the LSE Conservative Society and an alumnus now who works in the city. And I'm a passionate Remain fan, just to clarify.
My question is about the future of the Conservative Party, of what this means to the long-term electoral prospects of the party. I very much agree with Tim that at the higher echelons of the party, whatever the result is tomorrow morning, David Cameron will try and reunify the party by a reshuffle that brings in Gove into the cabinet and some other senior Leave figures. My question, however, though, is across the country, I found during this referendum campaign that local associations are divided, and to the extent that some are refusing to even talk to each other on the different sides of the debate. What does this mean for the Conservative Party going forward, and how are we going to bring this into the 2020 election to reunify the party?
Right, OK, three good and different questions. Which of you would like to go first? Sue? Patrick?
What?
Well, go on, Sue, and then Patrick.
Just on that last question, it seems to me that one of the things that may... I mean, you know, there are only 150,000, something like that, Tories out there in the country. I think it was the late, great Philip Gould, who was Labour strategist, but very much respected by a lot of Tories, who said the parties have been playing to empty stadiums for years. And it seems to me there has to be some sort of realignment of the political parties. They just do not speak for people in the way that they did 60 years ago when both Labour and the Tories had millions of members. And they're just diminishing and dwindling, and the media are partly responsible, of course. We concentrate who's in, who's out. Will he sack Priti Patel? What will he do with Andrea Lebsam? Surely there'll be a bit of revenge. I can't help feeling there will be, by the way. I think that there has to be some sort of realignment, and I think that, again, there is a prize to be had for the political leader who really finds a way to do this. Perhaps, as Tim and I think Patrick said, perhaps Cameron could be the man to do it on the back of a Remain vote, to establish a one-nation Toryism that is much bigger and more embracing than the traditional Tory party with these little tiny associations who, as you say, are often bitterly divided. But I think it needs to embrace other parties as well. I agree, by the way, with what you said over there, that you could argue on Labour that at least they didn't fall into the trap of being seen with the Tories. But on the other hand, how many ordinary people give a stuff whether it's Labour or Tory? What I think they care much more about is what is your policy on the health service or on Europe or on defence or whatever.
Okay, very good. Patrick, legitimacy, referendums.
Yes, of course, referenda are held in lots of different contexts and on lots of different reasons in lots of different ways. And Crimea, of course, was a thoroughly dubious referendum. But in a way, the referendum was a sort of a forcing of an issue by a leader of a semi-democracy. And, there's a certain sort of sense in which there is a similarity. You know, we're forcing an issue because we've excluded a group, we've excluded people from Parliament over decades. We've insisted on maintaining a party oligopoly between Conservatives and Labour. Samuel here thinks that it's very important, you know, the only thing important is really what's happening inside these 150,000 people. I don't really think that's very important at all. Only very cozy elite people think that that's very important. What's very important
to interrupt you, Pat, just a bit. Add to this, as Sue said, those 150,000 people will also elect the next prime minister.
Absolutely.
Can you pick that thought up too?
That's what's wrong with the system. And if I could sort of seg over to the Labour thing, I haven't said anything critical of the Labour Party. I don't actually think Jeremy Corbyn is doing a particularly bad job. There have been four by-elections since 2015. If voters wanted to get rid of Labour MPs, they could have voted against Labour. They haven't. Labour voters have been pretty solid. If we're looking at the opinion polls, it's basically 34% for the government and 30% for Labour. Labour hasn't lost touch. It's not flourishing, but it hasn't lost touch. I don't see any serious move against him. And in fact, I thought one of the great high points of the campaign was actually when Jeremy Corbyn appeared on Sky Television with a youthful audience and did a very remarkably good, considerate and well-phased job of discussing issues in an open and non-dismissive way without any of the kind of fear factors on either side
that have so disfigured this campaign. So I don't see any serious move against him, at least for another year.
Okay, Tim, and so that means it looks as if there were to be a vote to remain, that both the major party leaders are safe. Does that just mean we're back to British politics as before?
I'd be inclined to agree that Jeremy Corbyn, to me, doesn't look as though he's going anywhere too fast, and nor does David Cameron. And I think you might be right, actually, that in some ways Corbyn painting himself as a reluctant Remainer means that in some ways he was rather more in tune with a lot of Labour voters than a lot of Labour MPs. It's about the one issue on which he is more in tune with some Labour voters than his own MPs. On the question about referendums and legitimacy, I do think, and I was talking about this earlier with someone, that the one thing that can be said in favour of the referendum that we've had today is that, unlike a number of EU referendums in other countries, and I can think of, you know, the referendums in the Netherlands, in France, etc., I do think when people went into the polling booths today, they were actually voting on the question they were being asked to vote on. I don't think that there were many voters who were using this as a way of kicking the government, as so often the case in these referendums. I think people were genuinely voting on the question that they were being asked to vote on. Yes, of course, they were factoring in immigration. Yes, of course, they were factoring in the economy. But they were actually answering the question that they were asked. And that isn't true of quite a number of referendums on the EU. So I think that is important to say. In terms of the future of the Conservative Party, which is something I'm probably obsessed with as much as you are, and one of my tasks this weekend is to actually write the last 5 pages of the second edition of this book on the Conservative Party from Thatcher to Cameron, because I had to hold it to hear the result of this before it goes to the printers. I think probably if the result has gone the way it's supposedly gone, that makes those 5 pages rather easier to write, and probably means they won't date quite as badly as they might have done otherwise. I mean, I think... When will Cameron go?
If it's Remain.
Yeah.
When is he going to go?
Well, he's hoping 2019. He's hoping 2019. He might make it there. I think he might make it there. But what I wanted to say, to your point specifically, I think clearly you're right. You know, there's a lot of bad feeling in associations up and down the country. That's absolutely true. But you will know, because you're active in Conservative politics, there was a terrible amount of bad feeling over gay marriage, for example. People leaving the party, people not speaking to each other, people very angry at the stance that their MP had taken, if it was on one side or the other. And yet the Conservative Party, you know, pulled itself back together again to pull off this amazing win in 2015. I think referendums are, by definition, events which force people into either one position or the other. They're binary processes, right? But I think it is possible for people to come back together. Most people, in the end, are kind of grown-ups, really. And if they've lost, they've lost. Now, there will be a substantial minority on the Leave side who feel very, very aggrieved, and I acknowledge that. But for many people, I suspect that actually they will look at this. They will feel that the Conservative Party has now got probably 10 years in government, and they will probably look towards that and think about what the Conservative Party should be doing for those 10 years. That's perhaps less true at the level of the constituencies than it is in Parliament. But in Parliament, I feel absolutely sure that if you are an ambitious Tory MP who came in 2010, who came in 2015, and you are thinking about your career now, you're not going to spend the next 10 years relitigating a referendum that you've just lost. You're going to get on with it. You know, yes, it got personal, but in the end, as they say in, you know, The Sopranos or The Godfather or Peaky Blinders, you know, it's business, you know, and for most people, it is just business.
I mean, one thing that, thanks for that, one thing the panel can't see, and all of you can, of course, is there's an Ipsos Mori poll that's been conducted yesterday and today, as it says on the screen. That shows 54% remain, 46% leave. So we're in the same kind of ballpark, but on the same side of a line. Had it been the other side of the line, that would have all made us think long and hard. And I noticed that the pound is rising against sterling and the euro. Now we'll take one more set of questions. Yep, gentleman in the middle there. And we have two more. Right, you're away.
My name's Graham Shaw. I did economics here a long time ago. Nobody's talked about the position of George Osborne. I personally, not in favour of staying in the EU. I was absolutely incensed by some of the things that George Osborne did, not least the ridiculous £30 billion consequences in terms of his new budget after a Brexit. Would anybody care to comment on A, his chances of staying as Chancellor, and B, his chances of becoming next Conservative leader?
Okay, good question. And then where was the second one? I can't remember now. It's a female questioner.
Person up there.
Yeah, at the top. Hi, I'm Claudia Chvalish from Populis. My question is, do you think there's any chance of there being an early general election, given it would be unprecedented for the Tory membership to be choosing a sitting prime minister? And in that context, do you think there's also any chance of a new or a space for a new radically centrist political party to emerge?
Okay, good. They'll all have something to say on that. And Chandran, head of the LSE's government department.
Hi, Chandran Kukathas from the government department at LSE. This is a question mainly for Patrick, but I'd be interested in the other panellists' response as well. And I was interested in particular in Patrick's remarks about the way in which the elite dominate in British politics and perhaps to some extent are not so much out of touch with the electorate, but in a way completely disconnected with them. And he was suggesting that maybe we should look to the future to see how this might be repaired. And what I wondered was, well, maybe this is as good as it gets. Is there somewhere in the world where it actually works better than this? And that's not a note of optimism I'm sounding. It's maybe a note of scepticism.
Okay, again, three great questions. I'm going to... Patrick, you go first this time. Then Sue, then Tim.
Okay, it's true that elites dominate in lots of different ways, and you can point to... let's say countries which have very proportional electoral systems where, let's say, take Austria, for example, where just the other day a rather dull green guy just managed to pip a very charismatic far-right guy to the post of president. And the problem in Austria is they have a super proportional system. They have elections all the time. The same parties get the same share of the votes all the time. The same grand coalition of Christian Democrats and Social Democrats dominated Austrian politics for decades and decades. And so now Austria has a populist far-right party, as every country in Europe has a populist far-right party. And we know that in the USA they have the Trump candidacy, which is a very good populist far-right movement. And that's one of the big three challenges to democracy right across the world, is populist far-right movements. And the question is, well, where don't you have those? And you can find a few countries, Scandinavian countries, for example, which are a little bit better, where you have responsive parliaments. And that's really what the solution for the UK is. If people want to leave the EU, they should form a political party. They should campaign in fair elections. They should get votes in parliament. And they should, engage in a complex discursive process of convincing people to make the leave thing. They shouldn't try and force it through in a sort of electoral coup d'etat, which is really what we've been given an opportunity to do this time round. So I think we could do a lot better than where we are. It's not easy to do better, but it is very important to stop thinking that you just accept self-interested behaviour by elites as being perfectly normal and rational, and nothing to be done about that. Elites can behave in better and more public-interested ways if they want to. Will there be a general election? No, there won't.
you know, whoever is the next leader of the Conservative Party will be chosen by the party membership alone, like Gordon Brown was chosen without even a Labour leadership election.
Doesn't excuse it there.
Now, what about George Osborne? I'd have thought he'd still likely to be the next Tory leader. Because, you know, behaving in bad ways isn't a disqualifier from holding elite power in Britain.
See.
On George Osborne, he certainly hasn't had a very good war. I would agree that I don't think he's going to be moved or going to disappear, but I would put in just a very small punt on Theresa May, who is a Eurosceptic but who's supported Remain and who made one of the very few good speeches, I thought, of the campaign, saying we shouldn't crouch on the sidelines of Europe, we should stay in, get in there and lead and make them reform through our leadership. And I thought, A, it was positive, and B, it was also very clever politically, though I suspect she might actually have meant it. And it was so much better after all... Well, they don't often. No. After all these men sort of, oh, God, you know, I'm not having Johnny Continental telling me what to do. And to have, I don't wish to be sexist, but it was good to hear a woman taking a much more positive attitude, as indeed Nicola Sturgeon very often does in Scotland and runs rings round lots of the men. I agree there won't be a general election. I mean, have a heart. They only got in last May, just over a year ago. And when push comes to shove, what do MPs really care about? My seat. And they are not going to give it up in a hurry. They are not going to put themselves on the line. And whatever's happening nationally, politically, some of them are going to think, God, if there's a general election, I'll lose. So, no, I don't think there's any reason to do that. On the question of whether we could do it better, yes, I think we could, and I think we must. And you talked about other places. We are not the only ones. Our politicians are not the only ones who are finding that the public is turning their backs on them. I mean, you know, look at Spain, look at Italy, look at Marine Le Pen in France, and look, I don't know if he's touched down yet, but he's about to, Donald Trump. I mean, you know, can you do it worse than us? Oh, boy, yes, you can. Yeah. so I think it's almost a worldwide phenomenon. I think institutions like people do wear out. They do start to fail. They do need renewal from time to time. Sometimes they can last for 100 years, several hundred years. I think that we are at that point in the cycle, I mean, the whole of the West, and that there has to be some change.
OK, thanks, Hugh and Tim. I'm going to have to make you short and sharp because yep. I'm being given we need to finish signs. So
short and sharp. George Osborne as Chancellor may be the price that David Cameron has to pay for that reunification reshuffle, but that doesn't mean George Osborne won't get another big job. He may well get, for example, the Foreign Secretary ship, I would have thought. And I think he is still in with a shout, perhaps, of becoming leader in a few years' time, depending on what Boris Johnson does in the job that he may or may not accept from David Cameron. In terms of early general election, I think that is a possibility if we vote to leave. And, you know, I still want to leave that out there because I think whoever takes over from David Cameron would perhaps want their own mandate, and there are other good reasons perhaps for them to call a general election. Would we see a radical centrist party? I rather doubt it. I agree completely with Sue, actually, that we now have a party system that's a relic of the 19th century, early 20th century. It really doesn't fit with the way that public opinion works now, with the importance of cultural as well as economic issues in our politics. But it's very difficult to see, given the electoral system we have and given the grip that history tends to have on party systems, how we're actually going to be able to change that very quickly.
Great. Brilliant. OK, now I'm going to... the great and the good Conor Gearty asked an unhelpful question of the previous panel, and I'm not going to let mine get away without it. So I've done the sums. We've had two of these sort of not exit polls, one showing 53 and 54,
and the other two numbers, which, if you divide them both, you come to 53 on one side, 47 on the other. Okay? So let's just say, for the purposes of... staying in the microphone. For the purposes of where we are now, that those are... Well, let's test them. Do you think 53, 47, or something a bit more, or something a bit less? I'm going to put you on the spot, Tim. 53, 47,
well,
or something else?
Given that that was what exactly I suggested back in November, I'm going to stick with that because that would make me look like, you know, the king of prescience, so I'll go with that, yes.
How wise of the polls to have converged to your excellent view. Sue?
I agree broadly, but I think I would go for slightly more for Remain. I think 50, it's not much in it, but say 55. I mean, 55 is a bit of a magic number, but I think it could be that
Scottish referendum number. It would be seen as a big, against what's happened in the last couple of weeks, it would be seen as a very big number.
Yeah,
that's
a brave one.
Good. Patrick?
I think it's going to push back towards 50-50.
Right.
The way it goes.
We have a range of forecasts.
Did you ask David?
David. David, would you like to say whether you think 53-47 is about right?
The Scottish referendum, 55-45, had a very decisive effect
on
the management of Scottish politics. I think if the result is, as I suspect it's going to be, something like 55-45, it will have a very sobering effect on the no side.
Very good. Good way to end. You're nearer Sue than the other two, but we'll find out later this... tomorrow morning, actually. So, what I'd like... I don't move. I've got things to announce. First, I need to thank Patrick, Sue and Tim. Brilliant. Lovely questions. And David for his unruly interruptions from the front row. Thank you, David. I have to announce two things. The case for Brexit is being made by Professor Alan Sked in the Wolfson Theatre up there and that way. And at 11:15, there will be an opportunity for a press briefing. So, into all of this, ask loads of questions. Patrick will be there, I'll be there, others will be there, everybody will be there. And you can grab everybody anyway to talk to them if you want to. Thank you very much. And, by the way, the programme resumes in the hands of, things will get more again after that, Conor Gearty at 10 minutes past midnight, the next big session in here. But lots going on outside, including visiting the programme that's running with the 75 referendum. Sorry, 11:15, I've got another programme here. So 11:15, sorry about that. 11:15 in here, sorry, I was reading that, that's the amendment, sorry, reading the wrong one. Very good. No.
It's right to remind us that this is all exit of margin stuff.
It is.
To have a 94-year-old intervene with the key point. The key point. Manager's drunk in water and we know something we don't want.
Yeah. It's a good point. It's a good go. Good point.
Brilliant. So it's great session.
How are you? Good to see you.
Nice to see you again.
I do, absolutely, yes.
Good year ago.
Yes.
I wondered whether you'd give the minister to be in the interview.
Emily.
David, I'm going to speak to Chris Grayling now, who joins us from Milbank, the leader of the Commons. Chris Grayling, good evening. Thanks for joining us. I wonder what you're hearing about Nigel Farage. Has he conceded defeat? Has he unconceded? Terrible word.
Well, I'm a bit puzzled, frankly. I mean,
thank you.
for a general election, having promised to give the country a referendum and delivered that referendum, and we've had a lively debate over the last few weeks, but we're later tonight going to find out what the view of the people is. After that, we have to get on with the job of governing the country, and that means uniting behind David Cameron and carrying out implementing the manifesto we were elected on 15 months ago.
You would like David Cameron to stay on if it is a narrow victory for Remain?
I want him to stay regardless of the results. He's been a good Prime Minister. If we win the referendum tonight on the Leave side, we're going to need his skills to take us out of the European Union. If we're not successful, we need him to carry on delivering the change to the country that he's been doing for the past 6 years. So I'm very clear that we now all need to get back together again behind David Cameron and do the job we've got to do for the country, as well as keeping what is a very left-wing Labour opposition at bay.
And do you feel the same degree of warmth towards the Chancellor at this point? Were you one of the signatories saying they would stand against his austerity budget?
No, I wasn't. I always took that with a bit of a pinch of salt. I don't think that budget would ever have happened. But the reality is, of course, this has been a lively debate. There have been strong views on both sides. But now is the moment to say the polls are closed. It's now down to the counting of the votes of the British people. We have to accept that verdict and get on with government as good friends and colleagues, and people with a mission across the